Welcome to Feasting on Design. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. This week on the podcast, I'm chatting with Osh Egan, founder and creative director at Blind Tiger Design, a creative strategy and marketing agency specializing in the unique needs of the craft, food, and beverage industry. We chat about how she started Blind Tiger, changes in the beverage market that are leading to exciting new opportunities past designing for beer, how they manage client expectations, changes they were forced to make due to COVID, and so much more. Thank you to Hover for sponsoring this episode of Feasting on Design. Hover knows that you have incredible ideas waiting to come to life, and you need hamburgers in the dot news to make a name for yourself. Grab this domain and many more over at hover.com/feastingondesign for a 10% discount on all new purchases. Make a name for yourself with Hover. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/feastingondesign. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Feasting on Design patron, you'll get access to exciting Feasting on Design news before anyone else, plus stickers and t-shirts. So please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/feastingondesign. Osh, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's fun to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm excited. I talked to Harvey Shepard. Oh, gosh, it's probably been almost 4 years now. Mm-hmm. I had him on, I think, in the first year of my podcast, right about the time he was starting with you guys.
Yep. He was probably deep in the Oh Beautiful Beer trenches at that point.
He was. Yep. So he's how I found out about you guys, and I'm excited that we're finally able to connect and talk beer and beverages and all the wonderful things that you guys do over there.
All the pretty things you get to hold and drink.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, that's one of the perks of the job is you get free samples.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, that was one of the interesting things this last year with the pandemic. Normally we have this yearly routine of asking for samples for everyone. Yeah. And then in preparation for going to a conference to show it all off, but we don't want to ship full ones. So we have to empty them. So one of our yearly team activities is figuring out how to empty all of the samples that arrive before we have to ship for the conference, which is a very tough job.
I feel like there's really only one proper way to do it.
Right. Well, we did learn 1 year that you should not save the Imperial IPAs for last. Those are not what you want as your homework assignment the night before.
No, that'll get a little rough.
Yep.
Yeah, especially when you start getting into, you know, the ones that are not only, you know, high ABV, but also like double hopped and stuff like that.
Yes, exactly. Your palate is totally shot by the end of it. So
yeah, it just turns into a resin bomb.
It's kind of like going to Fresh Hop Fest or something. Yep.
Yeah. So how did you break into the beer world? How did you get started kind of, because you're very niche in what you do. How did you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, if you had asked me 15 years ago, if I would be living and breathing beer conversations on a daily basis, I would have thought that was a joke. It wouldn't have even been a thing way back when. My first entry into the beer world was actually what I thought was a practical joke being played on me by my husband. He kept sending me this Craigslist ad that said, "Do you like beer and do you like art? Email this person." And I thought for sure that can't be a real thing. I was teaching art at the time, and so at one point decided, well, why not during my lunch break when I had ceramic goo all over me, I'll go to this supposed place thinking it was going to be a big birthday surprise or something like that. Turns out it was a real job, and I got really excited about the real job because I did like beer and I did like art. And it was for a company that was just in its early stages, Tap Handles. The owner was wanting to really take it outside of just making table legs in the garage and really turn it into a creative point of sale piece. At the time, everything that was happening as far as beer Just to give perspective on that, there was no craft beer movement. All very, I'm dating myself, but this was before all of those words were a thing. So I was the sole designer, and I did everything from sculpting aliens to make them into a tap handle, to making table legs if that's what someone wanted, doing labels, doing whatever anyone threw my way. It was pretty innocent back then. Mm-hmm. It was literally me sculpting handles and putting them in my toaster oven. So it was very innocent. Conversations with clients were more in the form of, "Hi, my friends tell me I should sell my beer. What should I do?" Mm-hmm. Okay, well, do you have a logo? No, I should get one of those. Okay, well, do you have a name of a company? No, not yet. Okay, well, tell me about yourself. I really like my dog. Okay, well, how about I draw your dog and I sculpt your dog, and now you have a dog for a logo and you can start selling your beer. So it was all pretty innocent back then. It obviously matured along with the industry maturing. And as those requests came in more and more, how do I start a business? How do I actually maintain a business? How do I sell my beer? How do I market my beer? All of those kinds of requests just were so organic. And with that, I started growing my team to help with those requests. So I was doing everything from like basic startup business consulting all the way through to like national launch campaigns for really large breweries.
Oh, wow. That's pretty heavy duty.
It was a lot. Yeah. And it was fun because there was such an innocence and there was so much momentum going on with beer being this new exciting thing that everyone was wanting to get into and find new ways to do better and go up against the big guys. And there was just a lot of momentum when it comes to just that craft energy that was happening. Mm-hmm. It was definitely very artsy and very community-based. So that was really fun for me to be able to help these, you know, help people who were very committed to their craft. They were trying to figure out, how do I do this at a scale that goes beyond my garage? So there was just a lot of energy happening with that. At some point, though, after about 10 or so years, I realized that the helping people part was more of what I was excited about than the whole rest of it, with national campaigns and production of and sure. manufacturing and all of those other things that are hugely important, but just not what I wanted to put my energy towards. So that's when I left Tap Handles and started Blind Tiger.
Gotcha. So when you started Blind Tiger, you know, obviously you've had a breadth of experience in doing this stuff for people, but for lack of a better term, how do you go out on your own and
start your own company?
After you know, being somewhere for 10 years.
Yeah. It was a lot. I think the most interesting, when I think back on it, what was the craziest is that I wasn't, like most startups, you have, you know, one client or two clients, and then you grow from there. When I first hung that shingle, I was already with 50 plus clients, and I had commitments to active, you know, I had vendors I was negotiating with, I had clients, I had launches already in the mix, I had brands that I was already in the middle of supporting and mm-hmm. who already were out there in the market. So I was basically never started at zero. I was already one up. And, gotcha. And I also had a team. So when I left, I took my team, I took my clients, I took my book of work. So I was already in go mode, and but I no longer had, you know, the IT department to call. Longer had the HR department. I no longer had all of these larger business things that I had grown to appreciate and rely on. So that was the biggest learning curve for me, of just managing my own business. And it's, I mean, it's every day I'm still learning something new when it comes to running my own business, but I would not change it for a second, because the ability to, you know, be flexible with myself, but also with my team, and make decisions around what really makes sense for us and who we get excited about working with and what we're motivated by. That was much harder to do when I was part of a larger organization. And
sure, I can understand that.
Yeah, it was painful to learn all those things, but I'm definitely really glad that I have that flexibility now.
Yeah. With that increased flexibility that you have now, how have you used that to structure your own company?
Well, Osh has all these crazy ideas that I come up with. I think a lot of it motivated by my early years of being in the employee seat and just feeling like I didn't want to just be part of this wheel that I had no control over. And so flexibility is a big thing for me. And also just being inspired by actually having a life and having a family and having things outside of just sitting at a desk doing. I think that makes for better creative. And it also is so much of what Blind Tiger is literally being part of a community rather than just working for a community. So going to breweries, going to events, going to hanging out at the grocery store. Those are all legitimate ways that we can go out and see the world and see what's going on. And it contributes, being able to have the mental free space to do that contributes to people feeling like they are part of something. So that's been something that's been true since the beginning. Another thing would be there was one day where I had this crazy idea and I'm like, what if we try it? And then everyone said, anyone who has anyone who disagrees with this, don't say anything right now. I pitched the idea of 410s. And that was about, that was maybe a year into getting Blind Tiger started. And we've been 410s ever since. And especially when it comes to creative work, the 410 schedule is actually more profitable, more productive, more efficient. And it means that everyone gets a 3-day weekend every single weekend. And it's when you're working, you're so in it anyway that working an extra couple hours doesn't really, it's not that big of a push. It's actually a positive because you're in the middle of the project and you're just in go mode. And then you actually get time to recharge on the weekend.
Yeah. I worked for an agency to date myself, probably close to 15 years ago now. And during the summer we did 410s.
Yeah.
And that was because, you know, the owners of the agency had kids who were school age and, you know, they knew that they had a lot of activities going on and they needed to be able to be flexible. And, you know, but I really enjoyed it when it was that way. And then the last place that I worked before going out on my own, we did 4 9s and then a half day on Friday.
Okay.
Which was nice too. So,
yeah.
It was, you know, unfortunately, the half day on Friday almost never turned out to be a half day
only
on Friday.
Half a day.
That was the downside of it. But yeah, when it worked out, it was great.
I think the hardest part has been with that schedule when we've gotten really busy and we need to work sometimes more than 40 hours. Sure. It's been harder to kind of negotiate and figure out what the right timing is for that. But a lot of how we've built out our projects and how we've worked with our clients is really that we're an extension of their team. So part of that 410 schedule is also us being organized enough to know what's on deck for the week. And so all of the Blind Tiger team, each of us as creatives, we know what we need to accomplish within the week. And so sometimes you want to work on a big project that's really creative and drink your coffee and get really animated about it. And then other times you just want to be in go mode and not even thinking about it and kind of knock out a few small tasks. So it allows creatives to be more, rather than quick, right now, you have to be the most creative ever. It allows them to be a lot more, which is really hard to do. Exactly. So no one's on the spot as much because they have more autonomy to make decisions around what am I best productive doing right now, rather than what is a schedule dictating for me.
Gotcha. As the business has grown, how have you seen the beer world evolve?
Oh, geez. It's evolved many, many times over.
Sure.
I think my involvement in it has also evolved. So that might influence my take on it. But one of the there are many, many reasons why I branched out to do Blind Tiger. But one of them was that at the time I was seeing that the beer world from a consumer standpoint was no longer just people were no longer just beer drinkers. They were no longer just wine drinkers. They were starting to explore into multiple categories. And I felt like we needed to be a reflection of what was going on in the industry rather than holding ourselves to these guardrails that were kind of superficial. They weren't necessarily real anymore in terms of just being beer. Sure. I think we've seen that most recently with seltzer, hard seltzer being this joke that everyone was embarrassed to talk about and still to this day cracks jokes about it. If you're talking to like the real beer people, we saw that coming.
I don't get it. And I make jokes about it.
But. Yeah, there we go. I get why, if you think about it from a liquid standpoint, you're stripping all of the very things that every brewer is trying to do with brewing their beer. So you're trying to take all the flavor out. You're taking all the color out. You're taking everything out. And then you're adding, most of the time, some sort of fake flavor. So I get why a brewer...
And that's why I don't get it. That's
right. I get it. From a consumer standpoint, though, it's totally in line with... healthy for you or perceived healthy for you. It's why we're seeing hard kombuchas and kombucha and meal in a bottle. Like you name it, you're seeing all these new things emerge. And I think beverage is always going to be innovating. There's always going to be new types of liquids that are coming out and someone's constantly trying to evolve what that is. But from a category standpoint, there used to be beer or not beer. And now we're seeing a lot of other things in that not beer category.
Over the line a lot, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And people still don't know what to call it besides not beer, which is the funniest thing. I mean, even, the ones with all these huge focus groups and thousands of dollars going into data research, it's still, it could be called beyond beer or not beer or... off beer. There's all these different attempts at it, but there's no one consistent phrase for it yet.
Yeah, because I mean, from my understanding, they're still using the same processes to make it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they're changing the grain bill up so it's a neutral spirit.
Right. So flavored malt beverage is technically what most of them are. Although now you're starting to see some seltzers that are wine based or apple based. So those aren't necessarily the same thing as an FMB. Mm-hmm. There's also RTDs, which are ready to drinks, which is like a pre-mixed cocktail that is ready to go. There's a lot of logistics and regulatory hurdles that need to happen in the United States as to how spirits are taxed versus how cider is taxed or wine or beer, because there's all these different tax codes depending on what type of actual base it is. But I think that RTDs are going to probably be the next big thing. I feel like, especially the pandemic, I think has accelerated that. Think of how many restaurants now are doing cocktail kits to go. You can go and pick up your burrito and a margarita because the restaurants needed to find a way to be able to, get some of that revenue coming in. So I think you're going to see a lot more of those kind of kits or other non-typical beverages that maybe you used to only be able to experience if you went to your special bar, and now you'll be able to experience them at home.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's funny. It's living here in Alabama, we have some of the dumbest laws
all
around
sorts
beer
of crazy
and
laws
and
there.
Liquor and, and stuff that was one of the points when I knew the pandemic was a lot worse than I thought it was going to be, when they relaxed the rules and you could basically get pre-mixed beverages to go in the state of Alabama.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, even though I'm in it and I'm in the industry and I'm seeing I was seeing all the regulatory and the reasons behind those changes, it still is just kind of a bit shocking to see someone just, you know, walking out of a restaurant with a sippy cup and a straw and knowing that it's just tequila in there. It's just not used to that yet still.
I mean, here in Mobile, there's like downtown has an entertainment district where you can open carry in the entertainment district.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get out of that, you're breaking the law. And you know, I get that. I understand that.
Right.
But now they've opened it up where you can get those drinks to go and take them home with you. And,
right.
You know, but then, you know, I'm also 2 hours from New Orleans where they've had drive-through daiquiri stands forever.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the other thing that we've experienced just in all the conversations we've had with our clients, that the one of the trickiest things that the pandemic created wasn't just on the producer's side, but, you know, I had a lot of conversations with people who were like, oh, I got the liquid. I have no problem with that. They couldn't get a vessel to put the liquid in. So the can shortage is very real right now.
Getting shut down and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
So the vendor, having the vendors, the whole supply chain was completely messed with. So that was one of the first issues that came up. And then another big issue is that you can't sell at a grocery store unless you already have shelf placement. You can't sell at Costco or these big box stores at these huge volumes that people are going in and buying cases and cases and boxes to drink their way through the pandemic while they're quarantining at home. But they could only buy the stuff that was actually available on the shelf. And so in order to pitch a SKU to get it on the shelf, you have to have those buyers at the retail chains actually accepting new SKUs. And so for anyone who was already locked in, who already had things on shelf, they were great. As long as they can actually get the actual vessels, boxes to put their liquid in. Anyone who was trying to pitch, it's just now starting to open up to new SKU accepting, you know, these retail chains accepting new SKUs. So that's been a really big challenge, that whole trickle down of just basic supply chain management. Everyone thinks of it as, I just want my margarita or I just want my beer, but there's so many steps in between when it happens and when it gets into your hand.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't even considered, is those supply chain shortages, especially when it comes to like cans and stuff, because there was already a metal shortage before that.
Right.
Which is why part of the reason recycling has made such a big push in areas,
right,
is because it's cheaper to recycle now than it is to mine.
Right. Well, but then there's all these huge tariffs that have happened with actually, and then the tariffs are affecting both exporting and importing, and all of these trade wars going on have a direct effect on both the recycling side of things and also on the importing of new goods. So, you know, there's only a handful of can factories or plants in North America. And for a good while, there were no cans coming from Mexico and no cans coming from Canada. Even though, and there's a ton of producers that rely on those factories for all of their cans. So all of a sudden they're a million cans short on what they've already committed to. It's a serious wrench in the machine.
Yeah. I hadn't even considered that. So that's wow.
Especially when you think of it, it's only in Toronto. It's just right over it's just right there. I can smell it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah. It's rough times.
Yeah.
Yep.
When it comes to you guys, your business, you know, how has the pandemic affected you guys as far as, you know, like you said, it's hard to get SKUs on the shelves now and things like that. It's got to put a wrench in some of your business stream coming in as well, because they know that they're not going to be able to put stuff out.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it makes perfect sense that why would they spend money and energy developing a new product line if they can't even get it out into the market? So we had several projects get put of indefinitely on hold because they were right at the beginning and they didn't already have any sort of distributor or retailer buy-in. And so it didn't make sense for them to continue the development of a new brand or a new product line, knowing that there were so many question marks in play. Most of those have since started back up again because there's a lot more optimism about what 2021 is going to look like. And like I said, the retailers are starting to have those conversations again. So that's a good sign. But we're about half of what we were a year ago as far as work volume. We've had to let half of our team go. Which is rough. I mean, we think of ourselves as a family, and you know, everyone knows each other's kids and hangs out on a regular basis. We're all pretty close, and so that was difficult. But we also all of us could logic our way through it with understanding. Like it wasn't clients weren't leaving because they didn't want to work with us. They were leaving because they were literally shut down government mandate. I'd say about half of our work, both now and in the past, we really are an extension of someone's team. So rather than a brewery having an internal marketing team, they might have one or two people there who do some of the on-site stuff, but they rely on our team to kind of fill in the holes depending on what they're doing. So, understandably, they, you know, if they're shut down, they can't put on events. So they don't need us to work on posters and banners and event collateral. So all of that kind of work was, pretty much came to a screeching halt. But the rest of the work, as far as, anyone who did have distributor, commitments or retailer commitments, that work was able to continue. So, we've been able to, once kind of the shock of all of it happened, once we reduced down to about half, we're now back in a pretty stable spot as far as the work that routinely is coming in and the team that we have, which feels good to be able to say I'm somewhat stable now. And I'd also say that in the last, I don't know, last week or so, I've had a handful of conversations that really make me feel pretty optimistic about what next year's. I think that the pandemic has accelerated a lot of decision making. A lot of people who were not sure, do I want to go out on my own? Do I want to try this crazy idea? People are feeling like, yep, now's the time. If I'm going to do it, I might as well just like jump into it now. So having more conversations with some of those innovative products, new entrepreneurs who don't know the ropes yet, but they're trying to figure it out and are glad that we can be a resource for them to figure out how to even structure a business, how to even put all that stuff together outside of just the actual branding and marketing of the product itself.
When it comes to helping people structure the business, how does that process work for you guys?
Well, I would say, I mean, I'm not in the books with them, helping them on all of those X's and O's, but, from a sales and marketing perspective, we've gone through so many different scenarios over the years with how businesses have started, especially when it comes to understanding how to make a beverage company profitable, because there are so many different layers to that. When you're taproom focused versus your production focused, are most of your sales going to be happening outside of your four walls or inside of your four walls? A lot of those kinds of conversations where we can kind of walk someone through not just what do you need to do now, but also what is that going to turn into? How does that decision change what next year looks like and then the following year and then the following year? So that kind of pretty top level strategy is really helpful for someone when they've just literally never been to a distributor to try to pitch a new product or even a new retailer, things like that. So being able to be a resource for them in those kind of scenarios is really helpful for them being able to kind of get organized with, okay, if I'm doing this, what does that commitment actually look like outside of just everyone likes my drink?
Yeah, I've always been curious about that because I used to homebrew before I had kids, and I still try to every once in a while, but it's
harder.
I can't
devote
8 hours on a weekend to that. I've got other things to do, so I'll just do a quick extract brew that I can flavor a little bit
right
in there.
Right.
But you know, having been around the homebrew community down here, it's been interesting to see people who make the decision that they want to go from I make beer in my garage on a Saturday to I want to do this for a living. And I'm wondering how much hand holding you guys do when people are coming to you and making that decision?
Right. Well, I mean, in some ways I feel like the dude in his garage who's like, I think I want to do more of this. The biggest things for that conversation is realizing that as soon as you turn it into a commercial enterprise, you mm-hmm. now are not just brewing for yourself, and you can't just brew for your friends in order to actually make a business out of it. So it's really hard for someone to get honest feedback from people outside of their circle. Their family loves them. Their friends love them. Oh, this is great. But there's a very different threshold that a liquid has to pass when it comes to selling at any sort of volume. I think there's still a ton of room for, you know, once we all get to go out and actually hang out in tap rooms again, I think there's still plenty of room for that experience of it. So building a business around the experience means that the liquid is important, but it's only one of the piece of the pie that is critical. So you need to create a welcome environment. Are you family friendly? Are you not? If you are family friendly, well, you say you want kids here, but why don't you have a space for the kids, or at least have some popsicles in the freezer so that the kids aren't left without anything to indulge in as well. There's a lot of ways to kind of create that experience and have a profitable tap room. But as soon as you go to that production level, that's when all of a sudden you're really not brewing just for yourself. Now you're, you might want to make a new beer every time, and you like the creativity of it. And, oh, I felt like throwing this in. Well, in order to really get any sort of volume sales, you need to brew consistent, and you need to have the same flavor every single time. And there's no creativity when it comes to that. So I think that jump from being a creative, experimental, doing all these crazy things to being really a you're a slave to the production, and you have to just make it the same every time. And it's all about quality consistency every single time. It becomes less interesting for the person who started in the garage, where the whole point of it was throwing something in. I don't know. What's this shit? Why not? Let's throw that in too. You don't get to do that when you're selling to Safeway.
Yeah. So you mentioned something there that got me thinking is, you know, you guys are creating for these same beer styles for multiple companies over and over again. How do you keep yourselves from just becoming doing stuff by rote?
Same old thing over and over again?
You
know, we get this question a lot. I find that when you put yourself in a smaller box, it actually is, it forces you to be even more creative within that box. You know, if you have 10 IPAs all in front of you, you can't make them all the same. I mean, we're not doing our job as creative if we're just coming up with one design and putting it across all 10 of them. So I think for us, it's really about understanding each brand and how there's a unique voice, a unique personality, and unique story for every single one of those brands. And the IPA should reflect that, both in its liquid as well as what the design looks like for the can or the tap handle or what have you. So I think that philosophy around making sure that every brand has a foundation in what it's doing, all the way down to the approach with communication. Are they fun and playful? Are they serious about what they do? Are they production focused? All of those different ways to kind of categorize what a brand is. Really understanding the personality and having the beer and the design reflect that. It ends up not even being an issue. It's a non-issue by the time we're actually thinking about that IPA, because we're thinking about the Iron Horse IPA. We're thinking about the Alesmith IPA. We're thinking about these brands. We're not just thinking of it as liquid anymore.
Okay. When you are in the early discovery phases with your clients and all, how are you sussing out what makes them different and helping them develop their personality and in turn learning what their personality is?
I mean, we do a lot of casual conversations. There's a lot of collaboration that happens back and forth. We do a lot of presenting of ideas and seeing how they react. And that's probably one of the hardest things for our newer clients is they've never been through the process before, so they don't know how to react. They don't know how to look at something and say, I hate everything. It sucks. And they feel bad saying that, and they don't know how to articulate what they're actually thinking.
I can say, as a designer, nobody wants to hear that.
And no, right, right. You don't want to hear it, but we want to get to the point where, I mean, for us, we've been, and this has kind of been, gosh, since I was early college years, I would have instructors tell me, you need to have a style. You need to develop a style. You need to be known for a look. And I have fought that since forever ago, because
if you're a designer, you should not.
I should not have a style. My style should be whatever is appropriate for the brand that I'm working on. And if I look like something, then now everyone's going to look like that. And now everyone looks like me. That's not the point of this. The point is that they should look like them. So I think that philosophy through our whole Blind Tiger team, it has also really been a key factor. And there's a lot of educating, though, when we're bringing on these new brands, new clients that haven't gone through the process yet. They don't necessarily know how to communicate that. So they might feel it emotionally, but they don't know how to say it. The blue that we show, they'll hate it and they don't know why. But it's because their grandma's carpet was that color blue and they hated going there after school. But they don't know to say that until we kind of dig it out of them in a conversation. So conversation is a big thing. I guess also we rarely are working on brands where it's just created in a factory. Like we're working with mom and pops. We're working with husband, wife. We're working with father, son. We're working with, I've owned this brewery for 30 years and I know it needs to change, but I'm really scared. I don't want to mess it up. And it feels weird to change. How do I do that? So I think because a lot of the conversations, whether it's a brand new brand or whether it's someone that's 30 years old and already in the trenches with it, every time a brand comes to us, there's a conversation that's already starting that with, I know I have a problem, but I just don't know what yet. And I think that already kind of, it's like going to therapy. You don't necessarily know what you're going into, but you know that you need to have questions asked that might make you feel uncomfortable. So as soon as we can get into those conversations with people, it's usually pretty easy to get into the storytelling aspect of it. Some people are also just, there's just really obvious answers like, hi, I live on a hop farm. I'm a fifth generation hop farmer. I'm starting a brewery. Okay, well, I can work with that. That's something tangible, but not everyone has those kinds of stories. So it's just asking the right questions, kind of dig it out of them.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm curious about is, because creating beer and creating beverages and things like that does require a degree of creativity, how do you get them to embrace that they are creative people, because they may not see it that way?
Oh, for sure. Right. Well, I'd say there's some that think that they're creative, but they're able to say, I'm creative in my liquid, but I want you to reflect what I'm doing within my liquid. Mm-hmm. So they're at least able to kind of identify, I'm shitty at designing, but I know I'm not proud of this. Sometimes it's also just, there's certain phrases that will come up, that make the word pride comes up a lot. For me, when someone's saying like, I don't know, I go to these beer festivals and I feel like I'm the guy in the shitty t-shirt. I don't want to be that guy anymore. I want to be like, yeah, this is my brewery. This is my t-shirt, and feel proud about it. I think those are the kind of things that we can kind of grab onto. So we know that there is always a motivation behind what they're looking for. So for that scenario, now we know, okay, we need to get this person a t-shirt that they're going to feel really proud of. So we use that as, that's kind of our end game. We know we have to get to the point where he's really proud to wear the t-shirt to the beer festival. Someone else might be really proud to have their logo on a pint glass and see how clear their beer is, because they're really motivated by how clear they're able to make their beer. And that's the thing that they're really proud of. So usually it's kind of getting into the, I guess this is the therapy part, right? It's as designers, as creatives, we kind of have to allow ourselves that not everyone's going to have the same answer. And so figuring out what someone's internal personal motivation is, then we can use that as a way to ask all the rest of those questions, because it's all leading towards that one motivation that we know is really important to them.
Hey, Feasters, are you looking to start a new side project, like adding people's pets to Baroque portraits or designing 70s punk-themed craft beer cans? You're going to need a new domain, right? If you're going to register the domain BaroqueCats.art or BuzzcocksandBrews.com, Hover wants to help you make your weird little dream a reality. With Hover, you can register a domain name for your design portfolio. Hover has over 300 domain name extensions to choose from when building your brand online. No matter what the area of creative space you're in, there's a domain name waiting for it. From .design, .art, to .inc, .photo, and so much more. You'll find excellent technical support available to answer any questions you may have. Hover's easy-to-use UI makes it easier for you to buy a domain and get the email service to go with it. Plus, they have over 300 domain name extensions, so you can choose the right extension for your next project. Hover knows you have incredible ideas waiting to come to life, and you need Rococo Raccoons Eat.pizza to make a name for yourself. Grab this domain and many more over at hover.com/feastingondesign for a 10% discount on all new purchases. Make a name for yourself with Hover. I'm a huge fan of Design Cuts. It's an exceptional marketplace with highly curated, top-quality products and a wonderfully engaged community of creative people. They are constantly running incredible specials on bundle packs of design assets and fonts for up to 99% off the regular price. Their products are some of the best out there, and their customer service is top-notch. If you head over to feastingondesign.com/designcuts, you can check out their latest bundle pack at an exceptional discount and help support the podcast. If you haven't tried Webflow yet, when building a website, what are you waiting for? Webflow is a great no-code alternative to WordPress. You get so much more control over the design of the site compared to your traditional templated no-code sites like Squarespace or Wix. Give it a shot on your next site. Visit feastingondesign.com/webflow to sign up for your free trial today.
How are you putting them at ease to have those conversations? Because, like you said, it is kind of like therapy, and you've got to establish a trust with them for them to open up and let their guard down and be open to these new ideas that might be scary to them.
Right, right. Well, I'd say, you know, one of the things that we always do is we always give options. It's kind of like when you give your kids the option of, do you want broccoli or do you want carrots? You're not having them choose between like broccoli and candy. Like both of those options are you're totally okay with both of those options, but it's allowing them to feel like they have some power over the decision that they're making. So I just described my clients like they're my kids, but I think the point is there that, you know, it's about letting them feel empowered in the decisions that they're making and how they're making, how they're collaborating and how they're participating. But it's also us having enough control to only give them options that we know will actually play out in a successful manner. I think a lot of designers have ego and they can't get beyond that, like, but that's a shitty idea. I don't want to do that idea. So instead it's, okay, I'm going to take your shitty idea and I'm going to tell you our version of it. And then here's another way we could accomplish the same goal, but in a different way. So it's listening to them, but it's also showing that we're participating with that decision making, and they're not just like, because I think what is historically over and over again not worked is when it's just them as the client telling us what to do. As soon as it's not a back and forth in either direction, it just never works.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about, because I saw, I don't remember who it was, but somebody on either Instagram or Twitter the other day, they were talking about red flags for clients with them.
Right.
And it struck me as off and wrong, because one of their red flags was when a client says, we want to be collaborative. And I'm like, no, that's like,
that's the only way to do it. Yeah.
That's, you know, I don't want, when you say let's be collaborative, that doesn't mean I want you standing over my shoulder.
Right, right.
But I need your input. I need those boundaries to, you know, work within and know where I can push. And
well, I think there's also some responsibility on us as creatives to realize that not everyone thinks our way. They don't all see the world in the same way that they don't observe the world like we do. And so as soon as we can kind of acknowledge that, we also have to take on the responsibility of educating in a way that's not condescending and that's not telling them. So as soon as it's one direction telling the other direction what to do, it's not good. So I think collaboration, as long as it's in a respectful way, absolutely. And there's that I'm educating you about our process and how to participate and how to effectively participate. I think that is also on the responsibility on the client side, but it's hard. I acknowledge that it's hard. But I think it, as far as red flags, I mean, when I'm starting, before I've even talked about a project or proposals or any of that kind of stuff, I'm definitely using my people skills to pick up different flags in a conversation. Mm-hmm. How are they when I interrupt them? How are they when I talk to them? How are they when I ask about their kids? Okay, don't want to talk about the kids. Okay, noted. Like, there's all these different things that we have to be responsive of and allow for them to be them and not have every client fall into the same bucket. In the same way that we can't be the same designer for every single client, we can't expect all of them to be the same either.
Sure. How do you approach it? Because, you know, with those soft skills, you've got to be able to tell a story to your client as well, to pitch them on the idea and allow them to, as closely as possible, see it through your eyes.
Right.
How are you guys approaching that?
I would say that we do rely a lot on our experience. So being able to reference our case studies, reference things that are already out in the market, already out in the world, mm-hmm. that we've been there, done that. Those stories that we can share is something that gives our clients, especially our newer ones, a lot of comfort. Because they know that it's not the first time. And they also, they're like, oh, well, that makes me feel better knowing that I'm not the first one that's experienced it on their side. So I think the storytelling part of just other, we don't have to say the other clients' names or say the other brands, but just being able to reference past experiences is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I would also say that it's just about being personable and kind of asking them questions outside of just what is your, it's not just task-based conversation. So it allows things to kind of overflow and spill into other places. And then you end up hearing about things that aren't specific to the task, but it allows it to kind of expand into, oh, that actually now can influence how we're going about this project.
Okay. That makes sense. That's somewhat similar to how I approach things. It's comforting to hear that.
Well, that's good to hear also for me. I think when I talk with friends of mine that are true salespeople, I think that they sometimes, like in terms of being really rigid with sales, it's more about like it stops being about relationship and it's more about like, I need a thing. Okay. What thing do you need? Okay. The thing costs $10. Okay. I'll take two of those. Okay. Great. But if you allow it to be about this bigger thing, then all of a sudden you get the fries with that answer. You're like, oh, well, you asked for a thing, but actually the thing isn't actually what you need at all. You needed all these other things. So you have to kind of allow for every conversation to expand into things that are off topic. Otherwise, and then you're developing a true relationship with people. And if, which goes back to the flags that I look for, if someone isn't open to those conversations, then that's a flag for me. Because that means that they're just so task oriented that they're not going to be willing to see the big picture of how their brand could interact with the world. They're going to be so just like, nope, X, Y, Z, that's it.
That's kind of how I am. I'm dealing with a client now that I did not see those flags with at first. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to pop up, and keeping them on task is proving to be a challenge.
Right. Right. Well, also, I mean, it's hard because we as creatives get excited about things. And so if someone has a really cool project and it's very easy to get excited about it, and then we start saying like, oh yeah, I could totally do that. Oh yeah, I'm sure I can handle that budget. Oh yeah, I can totally take care of that timeline. No problem at all, because we just get so excited about things. And that excitement can give us foggy brain and not, sure. And then we pass over. It's pretty rare that because I definitely have dealt with client issues, but it's pretty rare that if I'm honest with myself, that those issues all of a sudden popped up. Like they were there early on. I just was foggy eyed and not actually paying attention to it because I was excited about the project.
That's generally what I've found on when it comes to clients that to end up being nightmare clients is the signs were all there. I just chose to ignore it because I thought the project was cool or I thought the money was too good to pass up or something like that.
Yeah. So, that's one thing. We've all been there. It makes me miss being in the office with my whole team because everyone's working from home right now. And one of the huge assets of working in a small studio where everyone could hear everything was also that they could hear these proposal conversations, these new inquiries that would call up and I would be in the middle of a conversation with, and I could just glance over and see team members kind of get a little bit upright in their chair, like, ooh, that wasn't a good thing for someone to ask. Ooh, I'm not sure about that. So we really are a whole team that participates. And so, you know, there's been several times where I'll get off a phone call and someone on my team's like, oh, I don't know about that one. That seemed like just flags all over the place. Are you sure we can actually pull that off within that time frame? Or are you sure that they're really going to be up for? So it's nice being able to have all of us really gut check each other, not just in terms of our design work, but also just the relationship side of things of like, if they're already giving you that much trouble, we haven't even started the project yet. It's just going to keep getting worse. Yeah. It's not going to get better.
Proposal yet.
Exactly. So I like having my sounding board around me.
Yeah, it is nice having a sounding board. It's my wife is my business partner. So that's one of those that.
Yeah.
You know, we know each other well enough that, you know, sometimes I will gloss over and, you know, get starry eyed at a project. And she's like, did you not hear what they said about this, this and this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, no, I totally missed that.
Yep.
So that's nice to it is nice to have sounding boards that have your back.
Yes, totally. Well, and I think also it's a short list, but I have had to fire clients. And in every single one of those scenarios, as soon as I did it, everything was better. It was better for them. It was better for us. And putting energy towards the positive things, more positive things come. So anytime, you know, and firing a client sounds pretty negative when I use that phrase, but they're... I think we have to acknowledge that people change over time, businesses change over time. Mm-hmm. And so there have been many relationships. I mean, I've probably worked with hundreds of different brands over the years. That doesn't mean I should still be working with all those same brands. And that's not a reflection of them being bad or me being bad. It's just, you know, there's different needs at different times. And so I think that's also part of that. I guess it's that therapy session again, internally and externally, of just being honest about, what is this really working? Is this good for you? Like, we need to figure this out and have a good rhythm with it.
Gotcha. I want to switch gears real quick and ask you about the industry as a whole and where you see trends heading as far as design goes with it.
Well, as far as beverage, I feel like, you know, so much, especially when it comes to beer, has really been cans. Mm-hmm. And it was a good couple years ago. I remember being at a conference and everyone was talking about cans, and there were people on the, oh yeah, it's going to change the world, everyone's going to be in cans. And then there were people going, oh yeah, right, it's just another trend. No one's going to drink beer out of a can. That's only for the big guys. It's only going to be in bottles. So I feel like there's these trends that come and go, and then there's certain things that are here to stay. There's a reason why cans are what everyone wants to package their beer in or their beverage in, because it's, you know, it's efficient to ship. It's just a very efficient package in terms of being able to store your liquid in it, recycling, all of those things. But I feel like the next thing needs to be packaging innovation, like the actual vessel that liquid goes in. I feel like there's opportunity for something to change with that, especially when it comes to just transportation and how and freshness, dry beverages in different ways. I think that there's opportunity for that. With maybe not with beer, but with, you know, like think evaporated milk or powdered milk. Like I think that I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing more of this.
I don't know that I've ever reconstituted powdered milk and tried to drink it.
I mean, I guess I just think there's, we need to think beyond just putting a different pretty picture on it. I feel like the pretty picture answer is the short-sighted answer, and it's working and it has worked, but there's more there to actually change the physical vessel itself. As far as the industry overall, I would say that we are going to continue seeing the beer, not beer conversation get worked out. There's a lot of NA products coming out there, NA beer, NA everything else. I think people genuinely do want to be healthier. They do want to understand what's going on, what liquid they're actually putting in their body. But people are not going to stop drinking liquid. So the reality is, I think there's just going to be more innovation and more diversity within what we see. So, you know, a year ago, you go to the grocery store and you see there's the beer aisle and there's the wine aisle. We're going to see a lot more diversity when you look down those aisles in the coming years. Mm-hmm. It's just that's what people are wanting. They're wanting lots of different things. And I think people are going to start figuring that out and start giving people more diverse answers.
What is your feeling on, you've got these big companies like InBev and all that buying up small craft breweries, and then, you know, just to hold on to that label and then changing things. What is your feelings behind that?
Oh, that's a tricky subject. I would shame no one if someone wanted to throw $1 million check at them and they were to say yes to it. So I feel like in a lot of ways, when the larger corporations come in and buy the small ones, there's not only negative things happening with that. There's you know, more resources, there's more consolidated resources for their ingredients, for their supplies, all of those things. So I think that there's probably going to be more of that. I would also like to think that there's going to be more co-ops where you might see six different breweries from different parts of the country co-oping together to be able to share resources and be able to have their product in different locations, even if they aren't physically in another location. I feel like the, especially in beer, the bigger, more, farther was the only MO for the longest time. And I think now I really look at Europe, where you have different regions that are kind of known for different styles and known for different types of beer. You go to Cologne and you drink a Kolsch. You go, you know, there's, I think that there's room for the states to start figuring that out and allow success doesn't have to be defined as bigger and in more locations. I'm already starting to see that. I think a lot of the, I guess the mid-sized regional breweries, we've seen them start to scale back and say, okay, we're going to concentrate more on our local region rather than trying to ship our beer across the country. I think that that will continue. And I guess maybe selfishly, I would like to see more of those experienced-based businesses happen. So rather than, like, be profitable, but just within your four walls, rather than trying to define success as I need someone drinking my beer in every single state.
Yeah. No, I would love to see, and this is part of this comes from me living in Alabama, where we've got such screwed up laws is, you know, you can now have a tasting room at your brewery and you can sell outside, but there can't be food on if you've got a tasting room. So they'll have to get like a food truck or something like that to come.
Right.
Which, you know, there's workarounds to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to see more collaborations where people do have, you know, like a brew pub style thing where it's much more of a family experience.
Yeah.
And be able to sell from there and then do regional sales that are in their regional market instead of, you know, trying to get to five states that touch them and stuff like that.
Well, also the three-tiered distribution rules, especially in Alabama, and several states are still kind of stuck with these archaic rules around literally not even being able to sell your own beer to people, which is just crazy. So I would, I mean, this isn't just beer. This is just small businesses. It's just, sad to see so much regulation and government, involvement in dictating how a business is even built, and how it can succeed. And, the hurdles that a business owner has to go through for one state and then to be able to sell across state lines and then to be like, there's just so much, so much that creates a challenge that, is just not really gaining anyone anything besides, you know, a way to steal some taxes, I suppose.
Gotcha. What's something that's going on now in the food and beverage industry that really excites you?
Ooh, that's a big one. Well, I do love seltzer. I do love cocktails. I do love other non-beer things. And so I've been really excited to see the restaurants that have been able to survive through the pandemic, innovating and figuring out ways to really bring that experience home. Being able to have this fine dining experience, both with food and beverage, at home on a Friday night delivered to you is pretty amazing. Some of the, you know, restaurants that are partnering with other people and or streets that are shutting down, and you can have this basically like you have a private table with all these beautiful patio lights and people waiting on you. Those are so many. Those are experiences that you would pay millions of dollars for. Only the millionaires get to experience that. So there have been positives that have come from the pandemic that I get excited about when I think about maybe those can stick around and they can be a positive for the business rather than just a way for someone to survive. So, I feel like it's the whole foodie, experience of just being able to really, shop local, eat local, experience local, support your local community and businesses and have everyone be a lot closer together. That I feel like I've had several experiences that have really given me a lot of positive hope for those kinds of things sticking around. And that's what I love about it. It's not just about, you know, boxes of beer. It's about the whole experience of it.
No, I'm looking forward to when things open back up again, because in the past year, well, really since 2019, here in Mobile, we've had, I think, three or four different breweries open up. And they've got limited release in stores. But I'm looking forward to being able to find them a little easier or go to their tasting room and try them actually in person. Because this is me being risk adverse when it comes to beer. The last thing I want to do is buy a six pack of something I don't like.
Right. There's way more commitment to it. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's where my commitment issues come in.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's
food and beverage.
Yeah. It's missing. I mean, we do a ton of work thinking about how do we tell the story on a can and get someone excited about buying it. But the reality is that beer is a very communal experience. People want to sit down next to the someone that they've never met before at the bar and say, oh, well, what are you drinking? That looks really tasty. Oh, tell me about it. Oh, I'll try one of those. And all of those kinds of natural experiences that happen organically in a taproom setting, you're just not going to have at the grocery store. It's impossible to transfer that over. And so I think all of us are craving that. And that is a huge part of what breeds innovation and breeds creativity, is just having those happenstance conversations that none of us could have predicted, which isn't just beer. I think that's creatives in general. I mean, we're just all craving that, right?
Yeah, I think so. Very much so. That's why I like creative conferences, because mm-hmm. I'm normally an introvert, but right. when I'm around other creative people, whether it's people who are, you know, doing the same thing that I do, or people who are interested in things that I am, like us having a conversation about, you know, beer and food and mm-hmm. stuff like that, like that, that's where my passion lies. That's what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So being able to have those experiences definitely opens the world up.
Yeah. And the shared experiences. And it's yes. harder to do that when you're at home with your six pack. I think variety packs, actually, that makes me think of all the variety packs. All the distributors are really pushing for variety packs right now. But the problem mm-hmm. with that is that they're selling really well. But we don't know that one can that's sitting in the back of everyone's fridge that no one likes the taste of because they weren't willing mm-hmm. to. But it's only the other five beers are only available in a variety pack. So you're going to still keep buying the variety pack. So
I've bought a few of those before.
Yeah. And you probably still have them sitting in the back of your, and now we don't have parties to bring all your I didn't like them.
My wife can't drink beer, so it's just me.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. She has celiac disease, so she can't have any of the fun stuff that, involves barley and malt and right. things like that.
Right.
So
she's probably able to enjoy things like the cocktail kits, stuff like that.
Probably. There's certain liquors that she does better with than others.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I feel like everybody's had that experience just totally. In general.
Oh, yeah.
But like, as far as aggravating her actual health condition,
yeah.
there's certain ones. But finding cocktail kits here is tough. It's mm-hmm. I mean, it's because I think in Alabama most of them have to be wine based cocktail.
Mm.
So it's, you're never really getting the real flavor.
The real
of something.
Thing. Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, I think there's a few exceptions. Like I know for a while, you know, Gosling's has the premixed dark and stormy. Mm-hmm. And you could find those for a while, but I haven't seen them. And I don't know if it was just they weren't selling or if they've stopped being able to sell them in Alabama.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know enough about the alcohol laws. I kind of stopped paying attention to them when homebrewing took a backseat.
Yeah. Well, it's
when
probably.
When I was no longer a felon.
Yeah. Yeah, you're definitely living in the land of a lot of regulations.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everyone has regulations and hoops they have to jump through, but just being able to self-distribute and have some creativity around how you get your product out there is a huge one that needs to be more universal.
Yep, I would completely agree. Well, we're getting close to our time, so I want to wrap things up. I always wrap things up with three food questions. But since you guys primarily deal in liquids, mm-hmm. I will amend them to be liquid related, beer, wine, whatever.
Okay.
What is the first alcoholic drink you remember drinking?
Oh, wow.
Not to get yourself in trouble with your mom.
Right. Oh, that makes me go backward even further, actually. So my mom drove, she was always drinking red wine, and the sound of the bottle pouring into the glass, the glug, 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 glug is mm-hmm. like, to this day, my brother and I will talk about that sound being such a trigger for us, where we hear that sound and we immediately think, oh, mom's having a glass of wine. So I would say red wine was, I wanted to see why she enjoyed it so much. Mm-hmm. And I did not care for it. I actually still don't really enjoy red wine. I'm more of a white wine or beer drinker.
I'm equal opportunity.
Okay.
I like them both. I really do. And seltzers are the only ones that I just haven't acquired a taste for. Like I get why people like them.
Right.
I just, for me, it's one of those, it's just like, no. Yeah. I'd rather just, you know, if I'm going to taste something like that, I'd rather get the cheap Walmart knockoff of a flavored seltzer water.
Yeah.
That's not alcoholic and just drink that.
You might as well just, exactly. Yeah.
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 What is, I usually ask, well, I'm just going to go ahead and ask, what's your go-to comfort food? We'll bounce back and forth. How about that?
That's, I'd say mac and cheese.
Mac and cheese?
Yeah.
That's a good choice.
Yeah. But homemade mac and cheese. My kids, actually, I have twin 14-year-old boys. And
oh, I've got twin 11-year-old boys.
Oh, how funny. Yeah. So just last night, actually, one of them says, I'm going to make some Kraft macaroni. And the other one was like, yes, that's awesome. And it, there was a huge disappointment when he found out it was Kraft with a K, not Kraft with a C. Cause he was like, oh, I thought you were making the homemade good stuff. I didn't want the Kraft stuff. So anyway, I guess that says a lot about how my kids, think and about
interpret the word Kraft.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, because mine would have gone for literally Kraft with a K.
Kraft with a K. Yeah. No, yeah. My boys are definitely very attuned to the Kraft. They're totally the kids that say, do you have any Kraft root beer on tap right now? So, yep.
No, we have Barks.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. They will have interesting stories to tell when they're older about Mama's company and all the conversations we have.
And then finally, what's your deathbed drink of choice? If you could only, or I guess it would be desert island. If you could only have one thing to drink forever on a desert island, what would it be?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is a Paloma. It's a grapefruit tequila,
yeah,
with lime seltzer. With some soda.
Yeah, I love those.
Yeah, it's just such a refreshing, it's kind of like a comfort drink for me, actually. Mm-hmm. It's so refreshing. It's rare that it doesn't fit with an occasion. So mm-hmm. If I had to choose one thing, I'd probably say Paloma.
Gotcha.
I feel like the beer girl, I'm supposed to say IPA, but I'm going to go Paloma.
You know, I got to say, I'm a huge beer fan, but IPA is one of my least favorite styles of beer.
Mm.
And I think it's probably one of my least favorite styles because so many people do it. Like the market is just so saturated with IPA.
Right.
I like malty beers much more than I like the bitter beers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like that's one of those things where, especially in the Northwest, we're so flooded with IPAs and very hop forward
there.
So you have not had a fresh hop beer until you've had a beer from in the Northwest where it's sure. literally like, you know, minutes from where the hops were grown. So,
yeah.
I was just talking to someone earlier who has lived in Seattle only for a couple years. And he was like, I shocked myself. I actually said no to the stout and yes to the IPA the other day. I guess I really am a Seattleite now. So, I feel like...
I do want to clarify. I like IPA.
Right, right. Just, but it's not your go-to.
It's not my go-to.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So. but yeah, if I was on a desert island, my drink would be something rum-based because there's so many different types of rum.
Yeah.
And styles of rum.
Yeah.
And there's so many things you can do with rum.
Yes.
So that would be my choice there. Well, Osh, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. Where can people find out more about you and Blind Tiger?
BlindTigerDesign.com. And all our contact information and everything is on there. And yeah, it's really fun having this conversation with you. And anyone is welcome to reach out if they have questions or want to want to have a conversation with me.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, and go out and break some bread.
Yes, exactly. With a Paloma.
Exactly.
Thank you to Hover for sponsoring this episode of Feasting on Design. Hover knows that you have incredible ideas waiting to come to life, and you need hamburgers in the .news to make a name for yourself. Grab this domain and many more over at hover.com/feastingondesign for a 10% discount on all new purchases. Make a name for yourself with Hover. You can find out more about Blind Tiger Design on their website, blindtigerdesign.com, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with them. I hope you like this episode of Feasting on Design. Let me know what you think. And if you like it, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram, or over on my website, ildisdesign.com.